A classic from the Olympics there. My baby loves Western movies. Yes, we did a movie-oriented and actor-oriented segue there in honor of our very special guest on the radio with us. His name is Rick Lenz, and he has had the connections and the people that this man has known during his rise in Hollywood as an actor, doing the film Cactus Flower. He was in a John Wayne movie. He was in a Jackie Gleason movie. And, of course, he was in a bunch of Rick Lenz movies. He's now written his memoir about it. It's called North of Hollywood. We want to welcome Rick Lenz to the neighborhood. Rick, can you hear me?
I can hear you, Rabbi Sal. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and thank you so much for being in the neighborhood with us. And so, I don't even know where to begin, because there's so many anecdotes, so many stories in your memoir, and also to your life. So, maybe we start at the end. Where are you right now? Are you comfortable? Are you happy? What's your situation right now?
I'm very happy. I'm standing in my bedroom because my wife and my niece are out in the next room, and so I got peace and quiet, and I'm looking out at my bougainvillea, which is still blooming a little bit in this month, and everything's fine in my life. I'm busy writing my next book, which is a novel, and things are good. Thank you.
Well, first of all, mazel tov. I know this is wife number three. Am I correct?
That's correct. That's correct. I like to, although she doesn't necessarily like it so much as I do, but I like to call her my third and final wife. We have been together 30 years now, so it counts, I think, as the last one.
God will, that halavai. And so, I say this not to make fun of the marriage life of Rick Lenz, but that this man has led a roller coaster up and down life in California, in Hollywood, trying to be an actor, making a lot of headway there, being probably getting more breaks than you ever thought you would until you were broken. So
yeah.
Let's have, in the quick fashion, the arc of your life. You're an NYU graduate. Were you in performing then?
Yeah, I went to University of Michigan and NYU, and I was a performer. I'd gone to New York from Michigan, where I came from, to try to, do the acting thing. And I finally got in a Broadway play called Cactus Flower, and did it there for about a year or so. And then I got I came out here to California to do Green Acres. I did a pilot, and then they put me in Green Acres. And one of the producers once took me out and said, I got this idea for a spinoff where you will go around the world with Arnold the Pig, who was really the star of Green Acres anyway. And so I was going to be the pig's lawyer. And I knew my mother had not raised any kids dippy enough to think it would be a good idea to be the international spokesman for a pig. So I said no to that project. And at the same time,
what I'm saying is you never know. I mean, my mother, the car was sort of a flop, but you also had, what was that, Knight Rider, which was all about a car. Who knows?
Know.
That could have been the biggest thing, bigger than MASH, bigger than...
I know.
You never know.
You never know. You really don't.
But still, you decided not to take the part to continue in a sequel or of the spinoff of the show. How was Green Acres? How did you like doing Green Acres with the Gabor woman?
Well, she was terrific. I later actually did a stage production of Arsenic and Old Lace with both Gabor sisters at one time, and that was a little tricky. But Ava was a dream to work with, but the two of them together in Arsenic and Old Lace in Chicago, that was kind of hard. They were playing the sisters, and they kind of made them one generation younger. And I played the Cary Grant role, which was fun.
Sure.
And but anyway, so I left Green Acres, and then when I was offered the role in the Broadway show, in the movie version of Cactus Flower, and that was terrific because I got to work with Walter Matthau and Ingrid Bergman and Goldie Hawn, and they were all wonderful.
All right. Let's one of the things, first of all, one of the things that I like about the book, which is called North of Hollywood, is that it's not just name-dropping. It's not just saying, oh, I get this a lot, and Dave does too, the host of this program, where, you know, you'll interview somebody and they'll have all these incredible names of luminaries, either in the music world or the acting world, and then they say, oh, yes, I worked with so-and-so, and they were great, and I worked there. And there's no stories. They're just saying, oh, I was with them, and they were great, and then they move on. And there's nothing to say about them. I remember Dave told me that he saw, not Milton Berle, but the really old guy. He's Mickey Rooney. Mickey Rooney is around doing a one-man show in these places. Yeah. Well, it's really one man, but he's got his wife up there to zip his pants because he's at that stage. And by the way, that is literal. That is literally true. That happened.
Oh, I believe it.
But he's up there. He's like, it's Mickey Rooney, right? He was in those movies with Judy Garland and Let's Put On a Show and The Black Stallion and everything this man has done. And he goes up there, and there's nothing that he's saying that you cannot read in Wikipedia. You know? All these people.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So, I preface this to ask you, first of all, tell a bit more about the Gabor sisters when they were working together. Didn't they have a thing about the script on this?
Oh, yes. First of all, they didn't have the same amount of lines, the characters in the play, so Ava and Zsa Zsa decided that they really needed to even the lines out, which is not a thing you really want to do to a good play, and that's a good play. So they spent the first few days of rehearsal making sure they had the same amount of lines, and they finally got that settled out. And then later there was a time when the rescue squad came and Ava had fainted. And apparently Zsa Zsa had gone into a department store in Chicago and spent lots and lots of money. And so they came to because Ava passed out from it when she found out. And as she woke up and she was just coming to, the rescue squad guy said, middle-aged female, and she passed out again.
Wonderful. Now we move to Cactus Flower. Now you've got this Broadway show, and you were on stage there. You almost just glided over the very fact that who was starring on Broadway with you in Cactus Flower?
It was Lauren Bacall.
Lauren Bacall, for God's sakes, yeah.
Yeah, and she was a rough customer. She liked things the way she liked them, and I'd come into the show. I'd been the understudy, and then I moved up into the role, and so I had to put my, when we had a dance together, and I had to make sure my feet were in exactly the same footprints that the guy before me had his feet, and so it was a little sticky being with her. And then when I came out and did the movie, I did it with Ingrid Bergman, and she was the easiest, most lovely woman I've ever, just one of the most terrific people you could meet. And she was just, I guess maybe partly she'd just been through a lot of stuff. They basically kicked her out of the country one time for, having an affair. I don't know if you recall, there was a thing in Congress, or if you ever heard of this, that they actually had a, what do they call it? They all sort of voted to censure her for, doing something wrong by leaving her husband for some other guy. And it was, I think, director Roberto Rossellini. So whatever she'd been through, she was this really terrific woman who had something nice to say to everybody. You couldn't. It was no way not to like her.
But also, I mean, in defense of Lauren Bacall and all her difficult stuff, wasn't she instrumental in either giving you the role on Broadway or in the movie?
Absolutely. On Broadway, she was the one who had the say. And if she hadn't liked me, I wouldn't have gotten the job, and then I wouldn't have gotten the movie. And I have nothing but thanks for her for that, because she just made it all possible. She was, everybody gets a, kind of big stroke of luck if they have a career at somewhere along the way. And Ingrid Bergman gave me that lovely moment.
So, also, you've moved from Broadway. Now you're doing the movie of Cactus Jack.
Right.
You've got to have stories about Walter Matthau. Because there's always Walter Matthau.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was just, you know, he was a constant cut-up. And we had to stop a lot of takes just so he could finish doing whatever whatever routine he was doing. They were largely physical. He would do things like, you know, stick napkins up his nose, and then we'd have to, you know, do another take. There was a story with Ingrid Bergman, because she was kind of, you know, known for having relationships, getting crushes on her leading men, but I don't think she had a crush on Walter Matthau. So I had a dance scene toward the end of the movie with her, and we rehearsed for that, and we talked a lot, and we got to be friends, and I kind of had this feeling that maybe she had this, you know, a little tiny crush on me, even though I was like 20 years younger. Maybe, I don't know, but anyway, so one time I was in the dancing sequence with her, the director, Gene Sachs, called cut, and he said, Rick, your hand is covering Ingrid's face, and I said, oh my God, they're going to drum me out of showbiz right already, because I've just ruined Ingrid Bergman's profile. But Ingrid just patted me in the back of the head. She was really nice. And then I thought even more that she had this crush on me. Then I saw her at the premiere in New York about, I don't know, a few months later. And I said, hi, Ingrid. And she said, oh, hi, Nick.
Oh.
And that wasn't quite right. So I realized that she really didn't have a crush on me.
Or maybe she had four crushes since, because she did three other movies. So you never know.
I know.
And the other person that you were with in that film was Goldie Hawn. Back when... Was it pre-Laughing? Was it post? When was that?
No, it was kind of... It was still in the middle of it. There was a season or two to go, but since she got an Academy Award for Cactus Flower, she was pretty much done with Laughing. I think she had one more season to go, I think, or maybe just finish out the one she was working on. But we got to be really, you know, good friends for a time, and she was a good pal for a while.
That's great. Why does that not last forever, though? What happens, and if you stay friends, you know, after a movie's over, why doesn't that continue?
Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. I mean, I have friends that are still my friends from a long time ago, but I think it's really hard, because after I did, you know, a few big movies at the beginning, then I started to be once again what I'd been before, which was, you know, trying to make my living, you know, and I was, you know, just doing the, you know, take whatever job you can get, and at times I get, you know, a nice role going for a while. But Goldie kind of rose, you know, in the business to, you know, like big time stardom, and she just, you know, was hanging up with, you know, Julie Christie and all those kind of people, and it gets to be uncomfortable. I think more for the person who's in her position than it would have been for me, and so we just kind of grew apart a little bit. Although we still, you know, exchange, you know, a note from time to time, and we're still friends.
Oh, that's lovely. That's great to hear. Because one thing that you make clear in the book is that when you were on the ascent, if you'll excuse that expression, in Hollywood, and doing these big movies, and you were also part of that Hollywood crowd, you were going and invited to all these parties, and you always almost felt like the redheaded stepchild at the party, the person, like, you should be coming through the kitchen instead of really being there. Am I right?
You're absolutely right. I felt like I was a fish out of water. You know, I'd gone to New York to be an actor. What I wanted to do was be an actor, and I just thought I'd be lucky to make a living at all and, you know, have a chance to work. And it got better than that, I was able to, you know, do, you know, a television series that I liked with Richard Boone, and, you know, a handful of movies that I had fun doing, and I made a good living for, you know, quite a while, and before the struggle began to get to be one of those day-to-day things, And most actors go through that at one time or another for a while. And so I forgot where I began. I hope you'll remind me.
No. Well, even better, let's do some more anecdotes of people that you've worked with in the movies. We're talking to Rick Lenz, by the way, the author of North of Hollywood, all about his experiences being an actor in these big movies and then some smaller movies and then in rehab. All that sort of thing. So, but going back to the movies, you did a film with John Wayne.
Yeah, that was fun. I really enjoyed that, and we hit it off well. And except the only thing that happened that was kind of funny was that I had one kind of major scene with him, and toward the end of it, he sticks this gun in my mouth. One time I was watching the Academy Awards just a few years ago, and they were showing, it was Brokeback, the year of Brokeback Mountain, and they showed cowboys from various movies kind of caressing their guns and, you know, handling their guns and everything, and they showed me with a great, huge 45, I guess, being stuck into my mouth by John Wayne in The Shootist, but I didn't care if I was being, you know, shown with a metaphorical, you know, in my mouth because I was on, you know, I'd never played to that large an audience before. Anyway, I'm sorry to rattle like this.
No, please, this is what it's all about.
Okay, we were on the front steps of this house where Lauren Bacall's character, she was in this too. In fact, she told me she told John Wayne she'd discovered me, and John Wayne said, "Oh, shut up, Betty." And he wasn't mean. He was just kind of, you know, he was just sort of
he wasn't going to put up with her being.
He didn't. Yeah. He didn't have any truck with the Hollywood stuff. He just, you know, didn't. Anyway, so he kind of pushed my head down, but he hit me with a gun instead of his hand, which he was supposed to. So they had to take a couple of stitches, and they sent me to the emergency room. And then I saw him a couple weeks later. We were going to finish the interior of that sequence. And he said, he kind of nodded at the back of my head and said, "How is it?" And I said, it's fine. It's nothing. And he said, "Well, I only ever did that once before." So that was my time with him. But he was, you know, he one time asked me what my politics were, and I knew what his were, and I had long hair, and I said, which was kind of a, you know, kind of said pretty much what's going on at that time anyway, and how long your hair was, and I said, "Oh, I'm not especially political," because I didn't want to get into, you know,
with
irritating
politics
him
with
by
John
my
Wayne.
Politics.
Right, he could crack you across the head with that gun again if he wanted to. So.
Yes, right, exactly.
It is,
by
the way,
want that.
We're just coming on 11 o'clock in the morning here, Mountain Time, on UNC Radio, the radio station of the University of Northern Colorado. You're listening to Dave's Gone By. I'm Rabbi Saul Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I'm speaking with Rick Lenz, Hollywood actor and occasionally New York actor as well, and playwright and author. His memoir, North of Hollywood, is available from BCH Books. And as you've been hearing, the memoir is chock full of stories, personal stories, with some of the greatest legends that we have known from television and film. People like Jackie Gleason. Go, Rick!
Well, he was a character too. He played my father, and I met him. We shot the film in Miami, but it was supposed to be Lourdes in France, where he had gone supposedly in this at the end of the script to get the cure, because he had some bad dental implant that had glue in it, and Anyway, so we're doing this scene, and it was my first scene on the picture, and it was my second picture, and Maureen O'Hara was playing my mother, and so I went up to, somebody introduced me to Jackie and said to Jackie, he said, "This is Rick Lenz, he's playing your son," and Jackie said, "What do you say, pal?" And kind of proffered me one kind of hand like he was the king of Prussia, and I shook hands with him, and it was hot in this. We were doing it, and I think it was supposed to be a hospital, but it was maybe, I don't know, a rest home. I'm not sure what it was. So they had this bedroom set up, and then a few minutes later, he was supposed to be really sick, and I threw myself across his chest and said, "Don't die, Pop," or something like that. And it was just the weirdest thing, because I'd come from the theater. It's where I spent my life, and the idea of beginning by throwing myself and hugging my dying father, who was Jackie Gleason, who was really kind of Ralph Crampton to me from The Honeymooners, was surreal.
Well, yeah, you're shooting this. You have to manufacture emotion immediately rather than build into it, of course.
But I also
wanted to ask about the Jackie Gleason film. Was someone else on the film? I guess it was Maureen O'Hara. Told brought him down to size because he was sober for the shooting of this film. What was the name of the film?
It was How Do I Love Thee.
How Do I Love Thee?
And I'll tell you who it was. It was Shelley Winters.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she was the one who said the line. I think the one you're maybe referring to is there was one sequence they were doing together, and I was on the set that day, and I wasn't in the scene, and they were rolling, and right in the middle of the scene, Jackie was kind of, I don't know what he was doing, but it didn't seem like it was quite right. And I got to interject here that I think he's a great actor when he's got the role, but I'm not sure this was the perfect role for him. Anyway, at some point in that scene I'm describing, Shelley Winters said, "Jackie, are you even trying?" And Jackie turned crimson, because you don't say anything like that to Jackie Gleason in those days. He'd have you fired on the spot, except it wasn't his series, and he couldn't do that, because Shelley was already established on film, but it was interesting.
Right, but unfortunately, it wasn't just the fact that she called him out on sleepwalking through the role. I think you say in the book that when she does that to him, he's so embarrassed and humiliated that he crawls right to the bottle, and he spends the rest of the film soused, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, he was going to get married later that summer, and he'd been off the sauce for most of the summer, and then he got back on it again, and it was one of my experiences of, and some of those, that generation of actors more than, currently, for example, it was really so much a part of the culture to drink a lot, and...
it became part of your culture, too, unfortunately. How did you spiral into madness?
Well, I came from a family. My father was one of a generation of doctors, some of whom believed that anxiety and whatever nerves of any kind was best dealt with by knockdown sedation, and so I got used to doing that, and then I drank as well, and so I had to go through a period of that, and then on top of that, my daughter was a rock singer for a while, and had a pretty successful group called Swamp Boogie Queen, and then they kind of fell apart, and then she got on the bad stuff, on all the stuff that people get on and at the worst, and so there were rehabs in and out, and my wife and I and Abigail, that's my daughter's mother, we all just did everything we could, and everybody else who loved her did too. And it's one of those things you don't want to live through again. And I now find that I have such, you know, I feel such compassion for kids who are going through that, or mostly the kids, but, you know, for the parents and anybody else who loves them. It's just something you don't want to see, and yet you keep seeing it all the time.
Well, actually, one of the things I noticed in the book when you were talking about a rehab center for your daughter, you mentioned Beit something. And is that one of the Rabbi Kunin places from the Chabad organization?
I don't remember Kunin. I don't remember that name, but it's called Beit Shuva, and it's it's in central Los Angeles, or actually more toward Culver City, and it's a great place. They do wonderful work there, and I have to tell you that I'm about as goyish a man as you will ever meet, and because I was there all the time. I taught improv there,
improv at Beit Teshuva?
Yes, I did. I talked to some of the kids there, and then one time I got bar mitzvahed,
okay.
Ritually, you know, in front of people, but it was kind of cool because, you know, it's one of those things where everybody should.
Did they give you a brisk tour or just the bar mitzvah? Kidding.
I read from the Torah, yes. And I can't remember exactly what else because I was very self-conscious, but I had the thing on and I don't have the proper name, but I had the yarmulke, of course, but I had the thing around my shoulders,
I'd love to hear these kinds of stories, these happy stories, although you start the book with something that probably on some level was a trigger eventually for your use of alcohol to deaden pain and all of that. I mean, you're an actor anyway, so we're all meshuggah. But the you had a story from childhood that is right out of something out of Stephen King,
and
no question that traumatized you. So on this happy Thanksgiving Saturday morning, will you kindly traumatize us with this incredibly horrible story?
Yeah, surely. It was. I went swimming one time when I was about, I don't know, 10 years old, I guess, with a friend, and we went to the area where I was raised is peppered by, you know, lakes all around the place, and we went to this one lake, and we went into the changing room at the county park, and my friend got done before I did, and he got out onto the dock, and there were some kids in the water, and they were just standing around the end of the dock and saying to my friend, "Jump in, Patty Waist." And so I saw him back up on the dock and take off toward the end and just launch himself into this kind of awkward jackknife sort of dive. And I remember shouting, his name was Dixie. I don't know why, but anyway. And I said, "Dixie, don't." Anyway, he went into the water and I never saw him again because the boys had been standing on their knees, which is about as dumb and, you know, stupid and in the end tragic a thing that could have happened. So he died a week later, my friend.
And you felt guilt for a very, very long time?
Yeah, I did, because I should have known. I still feel I should have known that something like that could happen. I don't know. I just, it felt wrong.
Can I ask, even though you're not...
That did color me.
Even though you're not Jewish, how many years have you been in therapy?
I had two times through. I had one time with a man for about 7 or 8 years, and then I had about the same amount of time with a lovely woman who was my kind of surrogate mother. My real mother was, you know, kind of a really troubled lady.
She was what, sorry?
She was a very troubled lady. It was one of those things where she's from the Midwest, and it was in that time where a woman had to be, it was pre, you know, God knows, pre women's lib, and And she was kind of trapped in this sort of, you know, white bread sort of small town. Not, you know, kind of a 50,000 was the size of my town, sure. Jackson. And but she just wasn't really meant to be in that situation. And I think she was carrying wounds that I'll never understand with her. So it was tough for both my sister and me to get through that, because she could do some rough things to us.
Well, let's move on to some happier, nicer.
Thank you.
Well, we got to delve. I mean, you write a memoir. It's not all roses and peaches and locks and knishes. There's other things involved. But let's get back to the locks and knishes. Tell us a nice story, a happy thing about Alan Alda.
He was one of my first experiences. I'm glad you asked that, because he was... He was one of my first experiences. I'd had a lot of, you know, and bunch of acting schools in New York and University of Michigan and NYU, and I'd been to a lot of that acting training. But I was doing a play early on back in the 60s. It was with him, and it was a light comedy called Sunday in New York. And we had, after we opened the show, he and I and the rest of the class, and he kind of led these improv group theater games, they call them. They're based on Viola Spolin, who was the mother of Paul Sills, who was the beginner of the Second City, out of which have come so many of those great, you know, comic actors like Alan Arkin and a lot of people. And anyway, so we were doing this. I were doing this these acting exercises. And in those exercises, there was no way to fail. It was just lovely, because you couldn't do it wrong. There was no wrong way to approach what you were doing. You know, the lesson that I kind of got out of that, kind of young, and I was really fortunate to come to it. And I think all of the group of us who were in that with him, you know, came out with the same thing, was that you don't have to do anything a certain way, and there's no wrong way, and all there is what it was a lack of, was a suspension of judgment. And it's like being, you know, like a painter. He has the feeling that he can, you know, sweep across the canvas any way he wants with a paintbrush, or whatever it is, that, you know, then you got a chance to experiment and find out what what you can do and what you might be able to do and that kind of thing. It was wonderful.
By the way, speaking, since you brought it up, of painting and art, you, among other things, among being an actor and a playwright and a novelist, now you're painting too. I've looked at you, it's pretty good. It's kind of like Captain Beefheart sort of style meets Yellow Submarine in a certain way.
Uh-huh.
Am I right?
That's pretty close. I like that a lot. Yeah. In fact, I'm going to write that down if you don't mind. No, it's just something that I got to doing. And that's another one of those things that maybe from, I don't know, a certain generation, and maybe before that too, you were kind of told, well, you can draw or you can't draw, or you can do this, you can't. And it's just the wrong thing to say to kids, I think, because no one person knows by seeing a couple of drawings whether a kid can draw or paint or, you know, or act or even, you know, anything. The world is wide open and everything's possible. And
there was a Harry Chapin song about that, about this kid who colors like the quote unquote wrong color.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. Reminds me of a Leonard Cohen song, which I can't think of the name of offhand. But anyway, it's that feeling, you know. That's how the light gets in.
Oh, yeah. There's a crack in the door, and that's how the light. Something like that. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. That's right. It's such a, you know, it's a great concept, because, you know, we are all cracked and messed up, and that is how the light gets in.
Well, we're shedding some light with Rick Lenz. Do you have another couple of minutes with us?
Sure do.
Oh, wonderful.
Sure,
well, just having a fantastic time talking to this painter and actor and author of North of Hollywood. And, of course, just have to ask more and more questions about the celebrities and the luminaries that you have hobnobbed with. Sometimes you've hobbed, sometimes you've nobbed, occasionally you've hobnobbed. Now,
right.
At a certain point, it's not your current wife, but or it may be, but it was the daughter of another Hollywood legend, a man who was in Casablanca, for crying out loud. What are your memories of Claude Rains, and how did you know him?
I knew him. I really basically met him on one long weekend. It was a Thanksgiving weekend, and it was, I don't know, a year or two before he died, and wife at the time, Jessica Rains, who was his only child, drove up there to spend the weekend with him, and he was kind of, there was a feeling about him of, you know, just being lonely, because he was sort of by himself, except for a woman at that time who was taking care of him, and he had, you know, a nice big home up there, but he was obviously, you know, longed for human company, and he, you know, read to me, you know, basically performed from, you know, scripts and books and so on, from, you know, various plays. He just did some Shakespeare and some Shaw and some other stuff that he liked, and you know, I was a big fan of his, because I think he was one of the great, you know, one of the great film actors, and he was just a fascinating and it seemed at the time lonely guy. But he's, I read my ex-wife's book. She wrote it with somebody else called, I think it's called An Actor's Voice, about Claude. And, it's, you know, he was a fascinating guy who had just a really rough childhood. He was raised as a Cockney kid. Mm-hmm. And he just developed this, you know, incredible speaking voice and, use of the English language. And, so he was something else.
That's wonderful. Again, story after story from Rick Lenz here. Now, let's get to a more modern-day actor. There's a really cute, and it's such a 1960s, 70s actory kind of story that has to do with Al Pacino.
Oh, yeah. Well, the first, you know, part of what I remember about Al, I never knew him that well, but a little bit, and we hung around some, and mostly because I was doing a play with his girlfriend at the time, who was Jill Clayburgh.
Oh, the late Jill Clayburgh, yeah.
Yeah, who died last year. It still makes me sad that she's gone this early. Anyway, we were doing a play. Jill and I were, and Al was hanging around with her, and I'd done Cactus Flower in one other movie, and Jill and Al and I were walking down the street, and Al, kind of loping along with his sort of distinctive gait, said to me, "I think I'm going to be in movies like you." And I don't do an Al Pacino very well, but anyway, I knew then that he was, you know, that he was an extraordinary actor. And
but that's not the story. The story was that he was at a one of these parties.
Oh, yeah.
And
oh, yeah,
he was at my house. Oh, sorry,
yeah.
Tell me.
He was at my house one time, and Jill was there, and a couple of other people, and he was about to begin the film Scarecrow with Gene Hackman, I think maybe the next day or so. And we were there, you know, at our house for the whole evening, and Al spent the entire time playing with my daughter Abigail, because he just didn't want to have, I don't know, an actor's studio kind of thing. He didn't want to have anything to do with any adults or relate to anybody, but he felt he could relate to my 3-year-old daughter. And so that's what he did all that evening, and it was very strange to have a party and Al spent the entire time just kind of babysitting Abigail.
And the funny postscript on that is a couple of years later. Yeah,
Yeah. Years later, I was watching, and I shouldn't have shown it to her, but anyway, she was older, and we were watching. This is bad fathering, but too late now. Anyway, we were watching Godfather 2, and she was older, and I could just see her face fall as she saw what a really evil guy Michael Corleone had turned into. you know, since the very beginning of the series, you know, beginning with the first movie. And I could see she was disappointed that this guy that she felt, you know, sort of viscerally sort of connected to had turned into such a meanie.
I love that. And this, yeah. Well, you know, you get caught up in a character. Even on stage, you'll see somebody, you know, they're a wonderful actor, but they play a right. rotter in the show, and you end up booing. You know, you don't want to clap so hard for them because they're like, you're nasty.
I know. I just saw a movie that a couple nights ago called This Is 40 with Paul Rudd, and I forget the woman's name who played the leading role. Anyway, this wonderful actress named Melissa McCarthy is in it, and I don't know if you've seen it, but at the end, under the credits, she does an improv thing that's kind of was just an extension of a scene from the movie, and it is so funny. It's, you know, it's worth seeing. It's a good movie. I like the movie, but it's good. It's worth seeing the movie just to watch, you know, her stay in character and just rail at Paul Rudd and his wife, saying you're some kind of bank commercial couple, and then she says a lot of other things that I can't say to you here, but.
You can say some of them. It's college radio, but we have to. Now, let me ask. I am curious. I haven't had the time to read the book all the way through, so I'm wondering, are there any, did you ever date any actresses, any Hollywood famous women there?
I had a little kind of relationship with, yeah, I had a couple, three.
Come on, name some names.
Okay, all right. I had a little relationship with a woman who was 10 years older than I was. We were doing Same Time Next Year, Vera Miles.
Oh, okay.
And we had a little friendship for a while. And we did that show for, I don't know, 4 or 5 months together, which was fun.
Well, it's a lovely play. Well, anybody else? Any other... people we would have
not really. I was, you know, I was married. I was kind of a serial monogamist for the most part. I had a few years between Jessica, my second wife, and being lucky enough to meet my third wife, Linda, who is, I would probably be dead without Linda.
You mean that quite literally?
Oh, I mean that very literally. Yeah. I had real bad habits, and it's one of those things where if you're with somebody who's just kind of normal and looks for the best in people and out of life, then it's really, you know, it can be a lifesaver. It just turned me around. I mean, I was very happy to have the therapy and all that, but I think the best therapy I got was to be lucky enough to, you know, end up with Linda.
Well, mit Mazel, mit Glick. I'm wondering, it wasn't just booze for you. It was also substances and other things.
No, yeah, it was my father's, you know, sent me pills, as I said, and I got onto those. No, I'm not blaming it on my father. I'm the one who took them, but I did for quite a while. And until one time I was doing a play, and I realized I was doing a radio spot to push the play, and it was early in the morning, and I could hardly get the words out, and I saw this look on the radio technician's face, and it was a look of contempt, and I never forgot that. And so a few months later, I just cold turkeyed on that stuff, and it was tough, but then I have never done it since.
And your daughter, by the way, is fine. Everything's she's.
Oh, she's fine. She's 6 years sober, and she has a beautiful daughter of her own. And it's almost treacly, but it's kind of a, you know, a nice happy ending.
It really. Can I ask you what now is your main career? In other words, what brings in any kind of income? Is it royalties from when movies show up, or you're still acting here and there? Is it from the book? Is it the painting? How do you have a career now?
Yeah, well, mostly what I'm doing now is I'm finding, for one thing, that the sales of this book are steadily increasing, which means I suppose there's some word of mouth out there, and so that makes me really happy. And I've got another. I've got a novel this time, I have very high hopes for that. And then I've got another one coming. So I really spend most of my days writing now. And I do some painting also, but it's just only so much time. And I found that as an actor, as I get older, a lot of the times you'll see people my age playing roles that they never would have played before, and they're kind of, you know, old white men functionaries who are kind of, you know, boring bankers and corporate guys you don't like, and, you know, that sort of thing. And it's not as much fun as it was, and not that I wouldn't play, you know, something that looked good to me, but for the most part, I've been writing, and I really love doing it, because you can get up and do it on your own terms when you want to, and it's really a hoot.
Well, it's a hoot talking to Rick Lenz here in the neighborhood, and also to read his book, North of Hollywood. I have one recommendation, though. If the book goes into a second printing, put in an index. Because that's what's meant.
Okay.
Because you tell your story in a very fragmented, kaleidoscopic way. Like, you know, one page would be an anecdote, and the next is all about your drugs, and then another anecdote, and then you're back. And I mean, it's really all over the place intentionally. And
that's a good idea. And we will be doing a second edition soon, so that's a really good idea.
Because, you know, if I want to go back and look at, what was that story about so-and-so? It's not there. You got a page for the whole thing, so...
You're the first person to say that, and I think it's a good idea.
Well, of course, you know. I read the Talmud for crying out loud. I know these things.
You have to.
So, Rick Lenz, would you kindly leave us with one more anecdote? It can be positive, funny, lovely, whatever. One more star anecdote from your life. Pick one.
Okay. I was, I don't know. I was doing the series, the Western series I did with Richard Boone, and we were off in the weeds, you know, and I guess maybe out on Fox Ranch in L.A., and we were about to make an entrance, and Dick said to me, "What am I doing here?" He said, I'm, and he gave his name, I guess, or his age at the time was maybe 55 or so. He said, I'm a teacher, and he was at the head, at the time, co-director of the Neighborhood Playhouse in New York, and he said, "What am I doing here?" And in the meantime, he was drinking, you know, out of a bottle, out of a, you know, a flask that he had stuck in his hip pocket, and he took a hit on the flask after that, and stuck it back in his pocket, and fell off his horse. It didn't hurt him a bit. He was so potted, he just got back on and rode in, and he was one of those actors who, if he had a bit to drink, didn't hurt him at all. He was still great. So that's that story.
That's cute. That's a Richard Boone story to go out with. Rick Lenz, not the best story, but it was pretty good. Rick Lenz.
No, so let me follow you with this. I did say, I remember writing in the book somewhere that, for, you know, that after, toward the end of the series, I said we got to be pretty good buddies, or at least good drinking buddies, and I said, but that's I love you. I love you. I remember the line. Doesn't matter anyway. It was kind of the way it is with drunks, because mostly I was a drunk, and he was doing a bit of drinking himself. So it was another one of those surreal moments where I was acting with Paladin, whom I kind of worshipped, or, you know, I thought was terrific when I was a kid, and there I am on a horse sitting next to him, and he's smashed, and I'm half smashed, and
it was the surreal. You get your dream, but it's from a sort of skewed angle, which is
exactly so. Exactly,
the nature skewed of Hollywood. It really is the nature of North of Hollywood. Oh, and you have a website, do you not?
Yes, I do. It's ricklenzauthor.com, or you can get to it also by just going to North of Hollywood.
There you go, ricklenzauthor.com. And Rick Lenz talking to us, thank you so much. I wish you much success with your novels, with your book North of Hollywood, and with all the other acting and painting that you're doing. And thank you so much for sharing this Thanksgiving Saturday with us.
It's my pleasure, Rabbi. It's a treat to talk to you. You are really good at your work.
Thank you, Dammit. Shalom to you.
Bye-bye. Shalom to you. Bye-bye.